Connor was silent. Dan saw why tears were pouring from his eyes, but he raised his head. He said, "Could I possibly be homeschooled?" Dan's heart almost broke, but he said, "You have to learn to face it, Connor, to gain control." "Don't be ridiculous," Caitlin said. "He does not. And the fact that Harley and Maggie keep letting these things happen is a big part of what's wrong with child rearing these days. They're passive, they believe in the mythical wisdom of the child. But children are savages and they need boundaries or they turn mean." She threw her arms around Connor. "You're the exception, love. You are a miracle, and if they can't handle that, then they're scum, that's all." Connor sighed. "Mom, they happen to be people I have to spend every day of my life with." He moved away from her. "So, Dr. Jeffers, what have we got? Come on, we'll go frame by frame from the top, making a note whenever a new point of proof is present in the frame. Hey, you could count the rivets in this thing if it had rivets. There's a lot here. This is wonderful, convincing footage." Dan hardly listened. He was in a state of complete turmoil. He had to understand about Marcy, and he did not. He just did not get it. Then he said, "I remember," he said. "What?" Caitlin snapped. Dan got out of there. His stomach felt as if it had just filled with a foamy storm of acid. He dashed upstairs and into the bathroom. "Dan," Caitlin called, following him. She found him on his hands and knees over the toilet, barfing like a sick dog. He rose to his feet and started yanking paper off the roll to clean up the considerable quantity of yellow froth that had missed. He worked furiously, perhaps not yet aware of her presence. "Dan," she said as she went down to him. She took the paper from him and flushed it away. They knelt there awkwardly, face to face. "It's impossible," he said. "It has to be impossible." How could he tell her what he thought he was remembering? He had not only been in some way connected with Marcy 2 nights ago. It was worse than that. His childhood seizures hadn't been seizures at all. They had been memories so extremely strange that it hadn't been possible to recognize them for what they were. "We're lab rats," he said, and then got sick again. As she nursed him through it, rather bravely, she thought, he gasped, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry," and it meant a whole lot of things, and she wasn't real sure what all of them were. He got up, shook his head. "Are you okay?" "We're in some sort of trouble." "Oh, yes." He took her in his arms and held her. "This goes deep," he whispered, "real deep." She wasn't sure she should, but she remained in his embrace. No matter how bizarre and how impossible it may seem, it had something to do with them.
Something to do with whom?
Them. It was Marcy screaming in that thing. She leaned back, looked at him. "I recognized her voice. It was all crazy with fear, but it was her yelling. It was certainly her." Caitlin could not think of how to react. She wasn't even sure exactly what he was trying to say. And yet the screaming had sounded vaguely familiar to her, too. She knew that he was right. It had indeed been Marcy, in the thing, with the alien, and absolutely terrified.
"How did she seem?"
"How did she seem? My God, that's too small a question. What in the name of all that's holy is going on here just begins to approach it. When I walked into her office, that sour, rigid woman was... oh, Lord, totally changed, love. All soft and steamy and really, really sold on me. That cold fish. As if her personality had been totally revised overnight." He paused. "Which is exactly what did happen, in my opinion."
"Aliens did something to Marcy because... why?
What does this have to do with the price of beans, Dan? Because you are an Irishman to your core and you might be a dull lecturer, but you can sing a song to a lady and I think I'm hearing a damn clever one now. I'm telling you the truth." She backed away from him, looked at him out of the corners of her eyes.
"You're telling me aliens, which you have always until 10 minutes ago thought were utter bullshit, made you do it?"
"I don't think I'm going to buy it, Danny-o. Nice try, though. On the fly like that, very impressive." Inside herself, though, she was much less sure.
It seemed to her that she'd had more than a glimpse of an alien down there on that video. She'd seen, ever so vaguely, into an aspect of life that she had never even dreamed existed. There was somebody behind the scenes, it appeared, stitching things together, and they were taking an interest in this neighborhood, and most specifically, she thought, in this family.
Caitlin, I have to tell you something. I believe that I was brought into that thing, that I was with Marcy in there because I have memories of that.
Oh, come on.
I have memories. Okay, don't have a cat.
So when did this happen? While I blinked my eyes, maybe? Remember, I was there most of the time, and you did not go into that thing. In fact, if you had, it'd be on the video.
Do you remember that you went to sleep with Connor afterward?
I was scared, and so was he.
I didn't want him left alone down there.
And when you woke up, you were up here, in bed up here, and we saw those marks, that strange water.
What if they were tracks, Caitlin?
Holes in the ground?
After we came back and went to sleep, that thing returned.
It brought her back after they'd knocked her out or whatever they did to her, and for whatever reason.
No, Dan, the aliens did not make you do it. That will not fly.
Okay.
Keep your voice down.
He pushed on because a lot rode on this. His whole life with her rode on this.
The thing is, Dan, listen to me. You listen because this is bizarre and impossible, but it is real and you need to wrap your mind around it.
I need to wrap my mind around your infidelity, and I will not be talked out of it.
Come on, Dan, at least respect my dignity as a human being.
Caitlin, that's your melodrama showing, and I accept that. Self-dramatization is a characteristic of people scarred by traumatic childhoods.
Analyze yourself, why don't you, my self-obsessed little boy?
I take that, and I accept that what I did was wrong, no matter what the explanation.
Okay, now we're getting somewhere.
Now will you listen?
All right, the star people made you do it. I'm fascinated.
I remember seeing her on a sort of black frame cot, and we were...
Something was happening.
He shuddered, then went to the sink and slugged water.
What would that have been?
Alien foreplay?
It was horrible, Caitlin.
Horrible.
They...
I remember some kind of sparks, and we were...
Oh, God.
Some sort of arcane thing where I kept seeing these sparks and hearing, like, her inner voice, her memories, her... Like some kind of inner scent. The smell of her soul.
Was there a rectal probe involved? Or is this even kinkier?
I deserve that, sure I do, but...
What, Dan? Don't talk in riddles, please.
When we were kids, I saw another girl under the same circumstances, with them. A girl that was you.
We didn't even know each other.
And yet, she did have certain disjointed memories that were really strange, that she had always thought involved child abuse by one of her mother's many boyfriends. She did not mention these memories to him, though, not just now. We knew each other, but not in normal life. We knew each other very well because they made sure we did. They made this family, Caitlin. We're damn lab rats is what we are.
Oh, come on. Look, we have guests. I'm going downstairs. Plus, the ever-alert Connor is going to figure out that we're fighting again, and do you really want him involved?
He is involved. He's heavily involved. Caitlin, don't you get it why he's so brilliant, so off the charts? He's theirs, Caitlin.
Oh, I don't think so. I really don't think so at all, because I seem to remember something about an epidural and a hell of a birthing struggle, and he is mine. My damn son.
Shh.
Don't you shush me.
First the aliens made you fuck that slut for your tenure, Professor Prostitute. Then you dare to tell me my son is some kind of pod person?
You're fucking certifiable is what you are.
I didn't say that. Of course he's our son, our flesh and blood. Who sweated through that labor with you? Who spent 17 hours, breathe? Who kissed your sweat and prayed with you?
Who was there, Caitlin, and is still here, and will always be here if you let me, and if you don't, will live still, yes, but will also be dead?
She looked at him. He looked at her. In that moment, something perhaps about the vow of marriage itself that is sacred reasserted itself, and the union decided to continue on, at least for the while.
Was that a question? She asked. He raised his eyebrows. She raised hers. He opened his arms. She went in.
Something so complex happened, it's like I've glimpsed a level of life that's normally hidden, where there are other motives and meanings that never normally come to light. And somehow, Marcy and I, and you and I, Caitlin, are connected on that level. And it's all to do with our boy. Somehow I know that. I know it, and I love him, and I love us, Caitlin. Oh, my God, so much.
We've got to be with him, she said.
They walked together from their dark bedroom. Out the east window, which overlooked the field where the thing had appeared, an enormous moon was rising. By its light, silver with frost, she could see the whole field, wrapped now in the familiar mystery of an ordinary night. She looked up toward higher space, the glowing dark of the deep sky. There were stars, a few, battling the flooding moonlight. Perhaps he was right. Maybe his struggle was, in some way, true. Maybe a shadow was there, one that you couldn't see, but that was nevertheless very real. The shadow of an unknown mind from a far place. He came beside her, put his arm around her. "They're watching," he whispered. She leaned against him, wondering what the future would bring. He might be going mad. It happened to people in middle age, and for a psychology professor to become psychologically abnormal had a certain irresistible irony to it, did it not? Then again, maybe aliens were the answer. Certainly the video was odd and disturbing. It had provided him an inventive excuse. She had to give him that. "Come on," she said. She pushed away from him and went back downstairs to rejoin the tormented odyssey of her son. Part 5. The Ministers of Death. No man is an island, entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a promontory were, as well as if a manor of thy friends or of thine own were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in mankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. John Donne, Meditation 17. 15. Lauren watched the colonel as he moved back and forth, back and forth. She'd never seen him like this, all of his rigorous professionalism gone, his eyes flickering from place to place like an animal looking for escape from a cage. "Where's Andy? Andy is supposed to meet us here."
"Andy is gone."
"And you don't know where, of course?"
"No, sir. I had no idea he would leave."
"You know your problem, Lauren. You're naive. Relentlessly damn naive."
Sir, I did everything I could. I only backed out of there because I had no choice."
"You didn't think to detain Andy?"
"Of course not. Why in the world would I do that?"
"You don't have the whole picture, I grant you that. With all his years in the hole working with you empaths, Andy knew a little more than you do."
"Has he, what has he done?"
"Run, you damn fool."
"Don't you take that tone with me."
He gave her a look that made her step away from him. He'd never been a pleasant man to work with, but he seemed violent now, and she did not like this. She did not like it at all. They were standing in his smoke-stained office. The fire department had saved the house, but the facility below was a total loss.
"I want to know the truth of this thing, Lauren, and I'm sorry to say that I don't think I'm getting it from you."
That made heat rise in her cheeks. She did not like her own professionalism challenged. "My report is correct in every detail."
"Don't you understand what happened even yet?"
"Of course I do. There was a grass fire. It spread to the air intake and flammables in the air dryers ignited. That's the official verdict, and it's also the truth."
"Then where's Adam?"
"Excuse me?"
"You do understand that there were no remains."
"Well, it was incinerated then. He was, I mean. All they pulled out of there was ash anyway, black sodden ash, I saw it."
"It's been gone through and there are no remains."
"He burned. And she was crying, thinking of him. He had a beautiful mind, you know, incredibly beautiful.
The skeleton is made of a metal that's quite indestructible. But we did not find that skeleton down there, and the rubble was sifted through screens. It was very carefully gone through, Lauren, so I think you must be lying to me.
You're beneath contempt, you know that?
He backhanded her. The blow came unexpectedly, a flash in her right eye. For a moment she was too stunned to understand what had hit her. Then she did understand, and a torrent of pure rage filled her.
That's a violation, she said, trying to force the anger out of her voice.
And I'm going to put you up on charges for it. She realized that he was laughing in her face, then that he was withdrawing a pistol from underneath his tunic. She was very quick of mind, which is one of the reasons that she was effective with Adam, and that quickness enabled her now to recall the rumors that people could get into lethal trouble in these deep black programs. Within perhaps 3 seconds of the weapon appearing, in fact before he even had it fully out, she had turned and left the room. Leaping down the stairs, she brought all of her considerable athleticism to bear. She hit the floor, staggered, and heard a gigantic roar. She knew that it was a shot. He was trying to kill her. She dashed across the hall as a second shot crashed into the wall beside the door. It was close. She could feel the heat of it on her cheek. He was a damn good shot, getting that close from that far away with a 45. She got the door open, and another shot rang out. She ran down the sidewalk and out into the middle of the street. She had to get this out in public. That was her only hope, and keep enough distance between them to make a hit a matter of luck. 50 feet at least. Closer, and he would not miss. She ran down the middle of the street zigzagging and not making the mistake of looking back. Damn this neighborhood, it was too damn quiet. Just one car, please, just one damn car. But there were none. Maybe not all of Dad's nightmares had been about the Grays. Maybe he had also feared this sort of thing happening to him one day. Then, as she rounded the corner, a lovely Mustang with two co-eds in it appeared. Help! She stood in front of them, waving her arms. Help! I need the police! Help me! As they swerved around her, she yelled into the car, Help me! They did not help her, and she ran on. Almost immediately, she heard the growling of a powerful engine and the whine of tires. He was turning the corner. She raced down the driveway of one of the large homes and threw herself down behind the garbage cans beside its garage. Hiding there, barely breathing, she heard a car stop. It was him. It had to be. She dared not look, dared not move, found herself hardly able to breathe. She had never been this scared, never remotely. She could almost literally feel the sensation of the gun pointing at her. She heard footsteps on the driveway, soft, quick, and then a loud click and some muttered words. A woman was there. Her remote control hadn't worked. She brought her car into the garage and the door began closing. Lauren sobbed, stood up, started toward the house. And in that moment, Wilkes's Phaeton came snarling up the driveway. She turned and ran, crashing past the garbage cans and down the side of the house across the expansive backyard where an elderly man struggled with a broken gate. Call the police, she shouted as she darted into the alley. Behind her, she heard Wilkes snap, Official business, to the old man. Curse him, the bastard was in uniform, too. She would get no help. She moved to the end of the alley, darted across the street and into the next alley. She pressed herself back into a tangle of bare bushes, hoping that he would miss her. A moment later, she saw him come out of the other alley. The gun was now concealed. He was breathing hard, his chest heaving. He looked up and down the street, then toward this alley. He stared a long time at the big shrub. He was looking right at her, but apparently couldn't see her. Then he took out the gun. He went down on one knee and braced it toward the shrub. She got ready to run. He snapped the barrel, and she froze. She bared her teeth, fighting the urge to break cover like a terrified pheasant. You did not need to do what he'd just done to cock a 45 automatic. Therefore, he'd done it for effect, to frighten her into moving. He was guessing. Finally, he stuffed the gun under his jacket and began hurrying away. A moment later, she heard his car start. She moved deeper into the alley and crouched down behind the edge of a shed. She could not be seen from the street at all. She called Ted on her cell.
Hey, bad girl.
Teddy, love, listen to me and listen close. Never go back to my apartment, never, at all, for anything.
What the hell are you saying?
Okay, Ted, I know how this sounds, but you'll be in terrible danger if you go back there. Don't even come in the neighborhood.
Lauren?
I'm not ditching you. I'm warning you. There's terrible danger, Ted. It has to do with my work, and I am extremely serious. If you go back there, you will be tortured and you will be killed. You just forget it. You forget me. You go on with your life.
She broke down then so badly that she held the cell phone away from her ear and gritted her teeth to keep from sobbing.
Lauren, what's going on?
She forced back the tears.
Where are you now? No, don't tell me. I shouldn't have asked, not on this phone.
Look, you can help us both. Go to the air police.
Tell them that Colonel Wilkes threatened us with a gun. Both of us.
He didn't.
He did. He threatened me. He shot at me.
Jesus!
But the air police weren't going to be able to help. They couldn't reach into a black program like hers. He would end up confronting all kinds of questions he couldn't answer and probably confronting Wilkes into the bargain.
No, I'm not thinking straight. Don't go near the air police. Move back on base and just go about your business. You'll be left alone.
Lauren, I love you.
Oh, Ted, no, you don't.
You were going to, but it hasn't happened yet because I ditch guys before it does happen, and stuff like this is the damn reason. You obey me on this. You trust me, and you obey me.
Silence.
Ted, promise.
You can't tell me a thing, can you?
Not one thing.
She closed her cell phone, leaned against the wall of the shed for a moment, then continued on.
She went down the alley to the next street and crossed it quickly. She continued this process, going down one alley and then the next, until she arrived on North Meridian at the edge of University Park. She went into a Starbucks and moved about, looking at the coffee machines and CDs, staying well away from the front of the store. She thought that Colonel Wilkes might well have licensed to kill her as a security risk. In fact, he would never have pulled his gun if he hadn't known for certain that he would get away with it. She remembered suddenly a story Andy had told her. At the time, it had seemed like so much scuttlebutt, the kind of thing that went down over beers. Now she knew that the tale of the code experts who were lobotomized in retirement, as lurid as it was, had been a veiled warning. Andy was gone because he'd understood the situation they were in the instant he found out what had happened. He was running, probably even had an escape plan all worked out for himself. She had no such plan, and zero confidence that she could survive very long at all in this situation. She had no operational training at all. Beyond the basic attack and defense maneuvers and gun skills she'd learned at Lackland, she was not capable. If she had Adam, though, things would be different. If she brought Adam back, instead of being a liability, she'd become an asset again. If Adam wasn't dead, and Wilkes had been certain that he wasn't, then where was he? Given how fast he could move and his ability to make himself so hard to see, he must have escaped without her seeing him go, left her behind to die. No, not Adam. He was always 10 moves ahead. He'd have known that she would escape on her own. Or maybe he hadn't wanted her to, or hadn't cared. Nobody had ever told her much of anything about the way the Greys functioned, whether they had bases or satellites or even exactly what they were, for that matter. So how would she go about finding somebody that weird, who had all these special powers and abilities? She could try remote viewing for him, but that only worked if you were completely calm, and anyway, she wasn't much good at it. All she was good at was making pictures for Adam, and seeing the ones he sent her. She couldn't reach him that way either, because that only worked from a few feet away. Oh, she could sense things about Adam from a distance, sort of intuit them. But there was no mind connection over distance that she'd ever experienced. So where did that leave her? She couldn't very well go on looking behind houses and in trash cans. There was no point at all trying to find Adam. Adam was lost to her. She was at a loss, getting so frantic that tears were forming in her eyes. This feeling of being trapped was just hideous, and it was panicking her and making it hard for her to think clearly. She decided that there was only one real option open to her. She had to go in. She had to go straight to Wrightpat and actually file a complaint against Wilkes. She was within her rights. The man had shot at her. If she was a liability, fine. The more public she became, the safer she'd be from the shot in the night. When she saw a bus pull past and stop at the corner, she hurried out of the store and got on it. It would go downtown, she was fairly sure.
I need to get to the Greyhound station, she told the driver.
First stop on Illinois, walk 2 blocks, you'll see the sign.
Thank you.
She took one of the seats in the very last row, because there were no windows beside it. She sat wondering what she might do, where she might go. She thought carefully. She knew that there were other aspects to the operation. Somebody watched for violations of the agreement with the Greys about who they could involve themselves with. But who? She had no idea, no way of finding out. Again, though, she might find out more at Wright-Patt. Officially, she was stationed there, on detail to the facility. Given that the facility was now inoperable, she couldn't be said to be violating any orders if she returned to base. In fact, that was likely her legal requirement. She saw that they were passing her condo. She looked up toward her windows, thinking that all her stuff was there, and maybe she would never see it again, or her cute little car that was still parked at the facility, or any of her old life, not Ted, or any of her friends. As she looked away, she felt a sudden shudder go through her body. And she was in the apartment, vivid, real, her bed still unmade, yesterday's skirt on the floor of the bedroom, a flat beer open on the kitchen counter, all of it just as it was. Then she was back in the bus. She knew it immediately. Adam was there. Adam was in her apartment. She jumped up.
Let me off. Let me off the bus. She hurried forward. Driver, you have to stop. Express to downtown, he said.
Idiot. She thought fast. They were a quarter of a mile away. The place was likely to be watched. She should not risk this. But it was her best shot. She was sure of it. If you don't stop this bus,
I'll throw up on your head.
She leaned over him and started gagging.
The bus was stopped, and the door was open, and she was running back up the street toward the condo. She was insane to be risking this, of course, but Adam was there. He must be. He had to be. That was Adam's mind broadcasting to hers. It was totally and completely unmistakable. As she ran, she looked for Mike's phaeton but didn't spot it. Maybe she'd outrun him. No, don't be a fool. Assume only the worst. You didn't need operational training to understand that. She went into the cleaners next door.
Hi, Mr. Simmons, she said.
Hey, Lauren.
She ducked behind the counter and headed to the back of the establishment.
Lauren?
Hey, Mrs. Fink, she said to the seamstress as she passed her sewing station and went out the back door.
She ran up the alley and then took the stairs down to the trash room and opened the steel outer door with her passkey, which fit all the building's outside locks. Going through into the basement, she hurried past Jake Silver, their handyman.
Miss Glass.
Hey there, Jake. Taking the back way today.
She went to the elevators and pressed the button.
You ain't supposed to come through there. That's not a door, Miss Glass.
The elevator opened, and she got in without responding to him. She started to punch 7, thought better of it, and took the car to the top floor, 9. The corridor was silent, the air smelling faintly of cooking. She went down the fire stairs and took them 2 flights. Her own corridor was just as quiet. She formed a thought, Adam's face, with a feeling of question attached to it. Instantly there came back another thought, an image of her own face. It wasn't Adam's usual signature, but it was certainly an image from him. She could tell by how it felt when it appeared, bursting out into her mind like a television picture. She opened the door and went into her flat. She stood in the doorway with the door still open behind her. From many, many questions she had put to Adam, she knew that whoever she really worked for was attempting to understand and use the process of communication by mind. They had even had her test the range, which was about a quarter of a mile, and could pass through anything except a certain type of electrical field, which was used at times to isolate Adam in the cage. She looked toward her bedroom. Everything was as she had seen it in the bus, every detail. In the back of her mind, she had been worrying that this was some kind of trick on Mike's part to draw her here, so now she closed the door and double-locked it, as if that would keep him out for more than a few seconds, and moved deeper into the apartment. She'd never been with Adam outside of the cage, and on one level she was fascinated to find out what this would be like. Hunching her shoulders to express an atmosphere of question, she moved into the center of the living room. With a faint click that made her gasp, the heat turned on.
Hello, she said.
Adam? Simultaneously, she projected an image of his face, well, not really his face, because she'd hardly ever actually seen it, except in glimpses, but sort of a generic face, long and thin, with big black eyes. There was a sound behind her. She turned, but there was nothing there. "Please don't hide," she said. "I need you now." Another noise came, behind her again. She turned and for a moment could not understand what she was seeing. There were two small creatures, each about 4 feet tall, standing near the broad picture window that crossed the front wall of the big living room. She was appalled at how insect-like they looked, shocked by the gleaming eyes, the expressionless faces, the gracile forms, insectoid children. As she stepped forward, they turned into two great vultures, black, their red and terrible eyes glaring, their huge beaks open, their wings spread in warning. A scream pealed out of her, totally involuntary, and she jumped away, only to feel something leap on her back. It held her arms down with an iron grip, its legs pressed against her hips. She could hear it breathing, an absolutely regular sound, like some sort of machine. Frantically, she projected an image of herself on her knees, then went down as best she could. She made an image of herself as a little girl. The two vultures postured, screaming, their wings spread wide. She projected an image of a beautiful garden, then of she and Adam sitting together, then of Adam with his head in her lap. Imaginary, of course. She'd never seen him so close. One of the greys before her became itself again. The other turned into an enormous hooded cobra, coiled against the wall. Its head raised a good 4 feet off the floor, the hood extended, its tongue licking the air. Then the one that had grabbed her disappeared. As she had at first with Adam, she sat down, closed her eyes, and cleared her mind. She brought a long-ago trip to the seaside to mind, the blue waves, the smell of suntan oil, the seagulls crying. "It's okay," she said. "I know you're scared. I'm scared, too. But Adam is my friend. I love Adam." She opened her hands on her knees. "I want to help you." The cobra swayed. The other gray stared at her. The one behind her slid its long hands around her neck. She made an image of Adam again, then of the ruined facility, then of Wilkes shooting at her, then of her running through along an alley. She fired these off fast, one after another. The cobra struck at her, and was suddenly a gray again, hanging in midair before her. She fought to quell her terror. The gray disappeared, but not completely. The three of them were racing around her, moving so fast through the air that they were blurs.